The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the episode for the 25th of July, 2013, in which we discuss the similarities between engineering and accounting. So, Brian, have you ever had to fill out some ridiculous expense report?
I believe I have. You're either trying to keep track of all of the lavish trips that engineers take, or often when you're building new components or new systems, you've got to go out and buy something from DigiKey and somehow make sure that it shows up in your multi-billion dollar accounting system.
Right. And does it seem a little ridiculous to you sometimes you're having to mess with keeping track of a $1.98 component when the corporation is doing several million dollars in billings every month?
It's even more fun to try to wade through about 900 to 1,000 different account types and filing numbers in order to find out which particular project and subproject that you're supposed to assign that expense to.
Yeah, well, things often get buried into those expense reports. And the subject that I wanted us to talk about today was how engineers and accounting get along. And there are some similarities between what accountants do and what engineers do. And accounting is an important business function. Most large businesses have accountants. And so where engineers and accountants tend to butt heads are this record-keeping issue. The accountants want records, you know, very detailed records kept, and the engineers don't see the need for that. So what I want to talk about today a little bit is how engineering and how accounting is the same and how we might better understand what accountants are up to. Before we get into that, a reminder again that we continue to look for guests on the Engineering Commons, and if you'd like to be on the show, share your engineering story, send us an email at admin@theengineeringcommons.com. And if you don't want to be on an entire episode, but you'd just like to ask a question or make a comment and appear on the show, you obviously can always put a note in the comments on our website, theengineeringcommons.com. But if you'd like to send us a WAV file of you asking a question or making a comment, we can incorporate that into the audio content of the show as well. So it's your chance to participate. So today we're going to talk a little bit about accounting. Even though we're engineers and we deal with the physical world, there's this whole financial world that business surround themselves with. And so engineers need to know the differences between revenues and profits and expenses and debt and overhead and variable costs. There are all these terms to accounting that have specific meanings, just as there are terms in engineering that have specific meanings. And so accounting is a method for recording and organizing and analyzing and reporting financial information. And sort of the main analogy to engineering is that in the accounting world, everything has to balance. We'll get into a little bit exactly what that equation of balance is, but in the engineering world, we have similar things in, say, Kirchhoff's current law, which says that all the current coming into a node has to sum to zero. Now, is that what actually is happening? Is there something called current going on?
I've heard several people take issue with Kirchhoff's current law that effectively he's saying that charge doesn't disappear.
Right.
And they also have called it the no-duh law and kind of wish that they were around in Kirchhoff's day, so that they could have collected the $200 as they passed go and get a law named after themselves.
Someone had to be the first one to say it. Why not him?
That's true.
So the idea is that we as engineers may see the balancing of accounts that accountants do as being sort of arbitrary, but they may see in our world the balancing of currents as being also somewhat arbitrary. Are currents really there? Is that really what's happening? No, there's electrons, you know, jumping between atoms, but it's a nice abstraction to call it current. and be able to do calculations based on current, and that makes us effective at our job.
Get the current low enough, you could be counting individual electrons.
Well, I guess that's true.
That was my that's senior true. Design project. That was a story for another time, but easier said than done.
Oh, I bet. For those that might be more mechanically inclined, a similar thing would be the energy balance that, you know, we're summing kinetic and potential energy all the way through some sort of motion of a solid body. And, you know, again, kinetic energy is not something we measure directly. We derive that from mass and velocity. Potential energy, again, we don't measure it directly. We derive it from other factors. Again, it's an abstraction that engineers use that makes it very valuable, in the same way that accountants are going to have certain equations that they have to balance that allows them to do their job in an effective way. So what I'm hoping we'll come away with is an understanding that we don't need to be always butting heads with the accountants. Perhaps if we understand what they're trying to do a little better, we can be a little more accommodating.
See, and I always have felt that accountants and engineers have way more in common, not just from maybe the unpopularity of our professions, but a similar worldview. I think the accountants I know and the engineers I know tend to be very intolerant of things that don't make sense. And I've often thought if I ever wanted to form like a political action group, I would call it the Engineers and Accountants. You know, all they would do is go around correcting things that are in the public domain that are wrong.
While that sounds like a wonderful idea, you'd have no one that would actually get up to give the stump speech.
You're right. We'd hire a business major for that.
Just a pretty faced poster boy.
Yes. Or like a text prompt.
Oh, there we go. Text to speech.
Exactly.
Yeah, you'd have all the the little videos that have the cartoon characters that are doing all the text to speech.
Yes, 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 yes.
You put out all your political viewpoints as one of those one of those YouTube videos.
I like it.
But I mean, I do sincerely. The accountants that I know, I think, have a very similar worldview in terms of the way they approach problems. Accounting rules, I don't know, are necessarily that arbitrary. They're more like laws. They're more like, you know, systems have to be stable. The equations have to balance.
I suppose the only difference that I see is that, and maybe this is not that much of a difference, but for engineers, Kirchhoff's laws still have to match up with the equations. There's still, we observe what happens in the physical world, and whatever tools we use has to match up with the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
Accounting, some of the decisions are somewhat arbitrary. I guess in the end, though, they have to match up to the world. If you had companies that were doing really well and the accounting rules showed really poor positions, then that wouldn't, you know, no one would hang with those accounting rules for very long. So I guess that in that there's some correction. There's a feedback loop that makes the accounting decisions match up with, you know, whether a company's doing well or poorly, in the same way that the physical world makes accounting or engineering equations align themselves with what happens in the real world.
But I mean, corporate accounting still has to reflect the underlying health of the business. And I mean, you can only play games for so long as smartest guys in the room had demonstrated in the early 2000s, referring to the Enron documentary.
Yeah, but they keep coming up with new tricks.
Yes. So. Oh, yes.
Well, let me move on here. I want to note that there's a difference between accounting and bookkeeping. And sometimes I think we as engineers think of accountants as being bookkeepers, that all they do are entering numbers into these ledgers. Well, it used to be ledgers, now, you know, it's a computer, but that all they do is collect numbers. And that's not really the case. Accounting is the analysis of these financial positions. So you would hire a bookkeeper to enter the numbers. You would hire an accountant to interpret the numbers and to pass judgment on the numbers and to audit and confirm the numbers. So there's a slight difference between what we think of as a bookkeeper and what the role of an accountant is.
So the bookkeeper tells you where you're spending money and the accountant tells you that you're losing money.
Yeah, actually that's pretty close to it. I mean, a good bookkeeper, obviously there's a broad spectrum. A good bookkeeper would be, I'm sure, have a good sense of whether the company is doing well or not. And I would suspect that the accountant would know the bookkeeping operations.
It's been my experience, and maybe I'm not looking closely enough over the shoulder of these people, but that at smaller companies, the accountants and the bookkeepers are pretty much the same people.
In smaller companies, they usually are. So what I want to cover today are a couple of types of accounting and a couple of the types of financial statements that accountants put out. Obviously, in a 1 hour podcast, we can't go into great depth. So I'll try to just hit the highlights as best I can.
Will we know how to cook the books by the time we're done?
No.
Is that part two?
we'll save that for if there's a great demand. If lots of people write in and leave messages on the website or send emails, then we'll consider part two and try to explain how the books get cooked.
Okay.
the engineering commons podcast becomes a short course in accounting.
Whatever. Maybe there's some young mobster who just needs any help he can get.
Right. So before we get into the accounting, let me quickly jump on the bookkeeping aspect. Bookkeeping is typically called, you'll hear about T accounts or T ledgers. And the idea in double entry bookkeeping, which is the common method of bookkeeping, is you've got debits on the left and credits on the right. And every transaction has to match up. There has to be something on the debit side and something on the credit side, and they have to balance out. They always have to balance out. And we're not going to go into that. If you want to go into that, take an accounting class, take a bookkeeping class. But the point to remember is that in the business world, the idea of debit and credit is reversed from what we think it is. Now, why is this? Well, this is because when the banks issued credit cards, we think of credit as being good. It's to our benefit. But a credit to the bank is a liability. They've loaned us money. So when you take a credit card and you spend it somewhere, then they've loaned you money. And so that's something they've got to collect. So the credit card is less good for them. It's increasing a liability. A debit card decreases their liability. And so that's why it gets called a debit card. So we would typically think of credit as good and debit as bad. In the business world, the debit is an increase in the asset and a credit is a decrease in the asset, which is just backwards of what we think it should be.
That is a very good analog in the electrical engineering world, where we have positive charge carriers as our convention, even though that's ridiculous.
They don't technically exist.
Well, they do in P-type semiconductors, don't they?
No. Hole is an absent. Hole, yes. Well, you just treat it like a particle, but really there's nothing there. You're just saying there are this many electrons not here.
So as another way of looking at this, a business likes to receive money and doesn't like to give it away?
Absolutely.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
All right. Well, I'll need to see some sources on this one.
Well, I'll tell you what. There are some businesses that like to give away money. They raise money and they spend it all on offices and nice park and nice cars and parking spaces and that kind of stuff, and they go out of business. So some businesses like to spend money, but they don't last very long.
That never happens in real life.
There's probably 6 or 7 cases I'm thinking of.
Right.
Total.
In the bookkeeping world, they keep these ledgers, these T accounts, and so each account has its own ledger, and the general ledger accumulates all of these, and so the accounts that we're keeping could be one of 5 types. It could be assets, liabilities, income, expenses, and equity. So there are many ways that a business can keep track of its accounting. One could imagine that any number of various configurations could be arranged or developed, but it would be very confusing if each business came up with its own accounting method. So for the most part, people follow what's known as GAAP, G-A-A-P, Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, and that is set forth by an organization called the Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB, F-A-S-B, that issues these rules and decisions and regulations. They're sort of like the
The IEEE of accounting.
The IEEE of accounting. Very good. Yeah. So they say when you have to report income and when you don't have to report income, and you know when dividends have to be paid out, and you know all those little rules that the accountants worry about. They go back to the FASB source book and say, well, here is the decision and here's why we have to do it this way.
So there's another thing that engineers and accountants have in common. None of us can come up with a good name for anything.
Right. And one of the other things that engineers and accountants have in common that I think is really important is what makes engineering, I think, difficult in many ways is the fact that we deal with dynamic systems. So it's not enough to know the starting state and the finishing state. I mean, we often solve problems for what's the steady state condition. But oftentimes our job is to figure out what's going on in between those two states. And so, you know, a dynamic system means that when we, if we're in a car, if we're sitting at a stoplight and we stomp on the gas, our rate of acceleration is going to be completely different than if we're going 90 miles an hour down the interstate and stomp on the gas. Our response depends upon our previous states. That's what makes it dynamic, because our current state depends on the past states. Well, in the same way, accounting has to deal with the timing of the flow of money. It's not enough just to add it up and say, well, I made money now and I spent money then. It doesn't matter. It all goes into one pot, because otherwise you run out of cash. If you spend all your money now and don't get paid until a year from now, you run out of cash and your business goes bankrupt. So in the same way that engineers have to deal with the timing of this dynamic system, so accountants have to worry about the dynamics of the cash flow. Is the money coming in? Is the money going out? Where is it going to come from?
Makes sense. Following you so far.
Okay. Well, so there are two main principles that accountants use in their decision-making process. Those are the matching principle and the principle of conservatism. So the matching principle says that the company's revenue should be matched with expenses. So if you sell a product in a certain month, then the expenses should be matched that month, so you don't end up with a certain month showing great revenues but no expenses, just because you, let's say you bought stuff in April and you sold it in May. Well, you should match those together so that you don't show a huge expense in April and a great income in May, but don't recognize the fact that your income in May was a result of the money you spent in April. So whenever there's a decision where, you know, which month and which account and where you put a cost or a revenue, or revenue or expense, the matching principle says you try to match it up so revenues are correctly matched with expenses to the extent possible.
Is this why financial years aren't the same as calendar years, sort of?
So financial years can start any month of the year. Typically, in fact, they don't have to start on the first, but almost always they start on the first. A lot of times they start on January 1st. If they don't start on January 1st, the second most common is they'll start on one of the quarters. So they'll start January 1st, April 1st, whatever it is, July 1st, and October 1st.
Yes.
Except I think I got these right.
Except during leap year. and then they may, for some reason, they may kick it back a month. Third, you know, less frequently they'll start on, you know, December 1st, something mm-hmm. like that. But there's no rule that they're – typically a company has freedom to choose what its fiscal year is going to be. And so that may be useful if they have, say, they do a lot of
– like if you sell a lot of stuff like during the holiday season, if you're a toy company, you'd want to wait and, you know, count that income from the holiday season and justify your yearly prototypes.
Exactly. So you may be in the midst of, if you had a fiscal year that started January 1st, then you'd have to close all your books December 31st. Well, if you're selling everything on December 25th or right before December 25th, and then you're having to take inventory, maybe you don't want to close your fiscal year on the 31st of December. Maybe you want to close it on the 31st of January. Mm-hmm. So that would be a good year. That would be a good reason to shift your fiscal year back a month so that you close your fiscal year at the end of February or at the end of January instead of the end of December.
Well, why should accountants get it so easy? I have to rush and get stuff out the door.
So would you say it's abuse of the matching principle or a violation of the matching principle to do things like, I'm sure every engineer has done something like this, shipped half completed capital equipment to a company so they can receive it 1 month and get it on their books, and then they ship it back to you so you can finish it.
So we'll get into that a little more as we go along, but those are the games that get played with the financial numbers.
Oh, sorry. Was that the second episode?
Yeah, that's part two. But I mean, that's a good analogy to what engineers do, is that fixes the problem immediately. That's like putting a Band-Aid on the issue, but that's not really fixing the problem. If you're having to ship the part so they show it as received, so they can clear it off their books, and then they have to ship it back so you can finish it. I mean, that's fixing the immediate problem, but there's some underlying problem in that corporation, or maybe both corporations, if that's happening. So somebody in management is saying, "Yeah, I allow that to go on," and either we weren't vigilant or diligent enough in watching what was happening so that we didn't get into this situation, or we've done a poor job in budgeting or estimating. All that said, these kind of things happen. You know, crises arise and people need to, you know, fix the problem in a way that doesn't stir the waters too much. And so you ship it and then ship it back and say, "We checked the box and now we'll try to solve the problem."
Mm-hmm.
The other principle that accountants use is the principle of conservatism, which means that if there's a decision about revenue or expense, the conservative choice is to always delay the revenue or accelerate the expense. And so I guess this is sort of analogous to the safety factor that engineers use. We make a calculation, but we always try to be on the conservative side. And so we use a safety factor to make sure that we're far enough on the conservative side of that issue.
Okay. It's like padding your project estimates, saying this will take me 2 months, and then a month comes by and you're like, "Oh, I might be done." You hide your, you give them, you make, I'm screwing it all up.
Well, yeah. So I have the rule of pi, which I've mentioned in several previous episodes, that you take your initial episode and multiply it by pi. So is that wrong? Well, the reason I use pi is because my initial estimates are always wrong to the short side. I never guess and I'm to the long side. I'm always short on my initial estimates because I don't know all the information.
Mm-hmm. So with accounting, you would want to say, "Oh, we're going to bring in, you know, $2 million this year." And then when it comes in at $2.5 million, you look good.
Right. So there's the trade-off of – there's a whole bit with budgeting, capital budgeting, deciding if your engineers come to you and say it's a $1 million project, do you budget $1 million? Do you budget three or two or 1.5?
0.8, because your engineers are efficient.
Okay. But here's the problem is it's not without a cost. If they say one and it costs 1.5 and you budget three, now your financial staff has to come up with that money because you put it in the budget. So now they have to decide, where's that money going to come from? And they've got to go out and either sell stock to raise money, or loan or borrow money to raise the funds, or push on sales to increase revenues earlier in the year so they can pay for this later in the year. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that goes on. It's truly a dynamic system. And so if every manager is bumping their estimates by an unreasonable amount, then you cause chaos on the financial side of the organization.
Now, does this reflect when you're recognizing payments or actually making the payments?
So there are two methods of accounting. There is cash accounting and accrual accounting. And so for the most part, small businesses use cash accounting because it's easy, it's the easiest, and big businesses are forced to use accrual accounting. And so the difference is, in cash accounting, when you spend the money, it's income, or it's expense. When you get the money, it's income. And it doesn't matter, you know, when the product showed up or when the product shipped, it's when you get the cash, mm-hmm. That's when you recognize what's going on. So big businesses, larger businesses, are forced to do their accounting on what's called an accrual basis, which means you have to account for things as they happen. So when work is done, it becomes an expense. When something is shipped, even though you've not been paid, It becomes income. So you have accounts receivable, which are the things you're owed, and accounts payable, which are things you owe. So these accounts payable and accounts receivable are things that come as a result of using the accrual basis of accounting rather than the cash method.
I think my mom used to do that kind of stuff when I was a little kid. She was in the accounting department of a law firm, and it sounds like they did accrual stuff.
And so there, we talked earlier about cooking the books. So there's nothing wrong with using if you're a smaller company, with using the cash basis of accounting. It's perfectly legal. Lots of companies do it. But here's the problem, is it may not give you an accurate view of what's going on. If you're spending lots of money on inventory and building up inventory, but you haven't paid for it now, you may go, hey, we're doing great because we're building up these assets, we're getting a lot of inventory, but you don't reflect it, you haven't paid for it. And so if you're doing cash basis, all the amount, the debts you're piling up that would, in an accrual basis, would go into accounts payable, which would scream to the financial executive, hey, we got problems, we owe lots of money. That's masked in a cash-based accounting method.
Gotcha. So you're saying it's kind of like a first order back of the envelope calculation that we would do just to get a rough idea of what's going on? Or it fits in certain systems, but once you get too complex, it falls apart?
Yeah. And so that's exactly why big businesses are forced to use an accrual accounting method, so to reflect what's actually going on and what they're – some more of the dynamics. I guess I'd say that cash accounting is more like a non-dynamic, a steady state system. You're just looking at where you end up, but you're not accounting for the time influence of the company's operations.
Gotcha. Okay.
Is that also what accounts for the difference in some companies where they can have high income, low cash flow because they're accumulating accounts receivable?
I don't know.
You pick up these little nuggets along the way. I was told at one point to avoid investing companies with enormous accounts receivable.
This is what accountants do, is they look at it and they can analyze what these things mean. So if you have huge accounts receivable, it means that you've been giving your product away and nobody's been paying you.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe those accounts receivable are stale and you've not written them off the books. That means that you've sold your product. Somebody's taken the delivery of the goods, but they haven't paid you. And it depends on your industry. In some industries, a payment's expected, cash on delivery. Sometimes it's 60 days. Sometimes it's 90 days. These days, big corporations love to push small companies out to 120 days. Okay, well, at what point do you say, I'm never going to get this money back? So taking a look at the accounts receivable can give you sort of an idea of the health of the business, but you have to know what the industry is and what the norms are to be able to compare it to something else.
That's something along with regulatory compliance and product qualification that I think oftentimes young entrepreneurial engineers take for granted, that they might budget for a project and expect, hey, I can buy these boards or buy these parts and ship it out, maybe carry it on credit. And you're not used to the conventions of how long it's going to take to actually extract money from the people you've shipped your product to.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that if you're a consumer, you are very used to the fact that you can dial up someplace on the internet most times and find something and pay for it with a credit card and get it shipped overnight, and you go, what's the big deal? But you get out in an industry, there's an awful lot of products where they don't have it sitting around. When you order it, it's not like Amazon goes and pulls the product off the shelf somewhere. You have a special motor or a drive system. They have to make it. And sometimes a lot of times they'll say, 5 to 7 days or working days, something like that. Sometimes it's 5 to 7 weeks. Sometimes it's 5 to 7 months, depending on how rare and how difficult it is to make this thing. And so now that not only do you have to, as an engineer, worry about where that fits into your flow of trying to make the product or get the product developed, but also the financial guys. If this is a big expense Now you have to let accounting know that 7 months from now, I've got a $500,000 order coming through, and they have to start planning. You know, where do we raise the money from when that invoice hits our desk? Are we going to be able to pay it? Because $500,000 doesn't just find itself.
Maybe the couch cushions of Apple.
Well, maybe.
All right. So it sounds like so far the accounting guys are big picture stuff. They're not the ones, you know, running around flicking off light switches as you walk in and out of rooms to save money.
Well, maybe they are and maybe they aren't. I would say more typically it'd be the managers that would be those types, because they, you know, they often get judged on how those numbers turn out. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a certain sales quota or you've got a certain expense level or expense ratio that you have to hit, you'll do just about, you know, anything to get there. I remember working at a company where they made little post-it notes that had the company logo on it for handing out to customers. Mm-hmm. And so people in the plant got used to grabbing those, you know, when they needed something to write on as a post-it note, they grab one of those and start jotting on it. And the manager went crazy going, you know, you're costing me, you know, a penny a post-it note or 2 cents a post-it note. And so while it was difficult for the employees to understand why that was an issue, the manager was looking at, okay, I've got 20 people in the office all going through, you know, 50 post-it notes a week. You know, it starts to add up. And even though it might be, you know, it might only be 10 or 20 bucks a year, hey, that's 10 or 20 bucks that, you know, otherwise we have to make in revenue. So, you know, I think that more typically it's the, you know, the accountants do the analysis, but it's the managers that tend to swing the hammer.
Gotcha.
Okay. Accountants typically do one of two types of accounting. I mean, an accountant can swing between both of these types of accounting, but typically there's a financial accounting and there's managerial accounting. And so financial accounting is the preparation of financial statements that you present to external stakeholders. So what do I mean by that? So stakeholders are anyone that has an interest in the performance of the company. So employees, managers are stakeholders. Stockholders are obviously stakeholders. But customers can be stakeholders. You know, if Apple falls off the face of the earth, then there's a lot of people with Apple products that would be influenced by that, would not be happy if that happened. So anybody that has an external interest in the company is considered an external stakeholder. And so financial accounting is an effort to express the financial health of the company to those outside the company. And so you might guess that businesses want to do just enough to get by. That is, they don't want to reveal all their secrets in a financial statement. So this comes back to the GAAP rules, the generally accepted accounting practices. There are certain things that either the government says you have to show us or GAAP says you have to show. And so you have to show revenue and you have to show expenses, but you probably are not going to list it out in detail where you go research on the new laser widget, $1.2 million, because you don't want to tip off your competitors that you're working on a laser widget.
Of course not.
So the financial accounting has very specific documents that get turned out, and they're you know, well regulated and they're very standardized. The other type of accounting is managerial accounting, and that addresses the needs of internal stakeholders. So if you're a manager, you probably want to know how much you're spending on the laser widget project. You probably want to know how many hours your engineering department is spending on a product versus your manufacturing department. You probably want to be forecasting budgets. You want to be looking forward more than you do on financial statements. So financial statements tend to be backward looking to tell you how the company has done. Managerial accounting tends to be more intended to allow you to look forward and say, how are we going to perform in the future? How are we going to manage things like raising funds? So from the control standpoint, from the control world, if you look back, PID control is you're always looking back, you know, you're looking in the rearview mirror to see what's happened and adjusting your trajectory based on that. Model predictive control, you're looking forward and trying to figure out where you're going to be in several steps and making decisions based on that.
You read my mind. I was trying to make that analogy, but I couldn't quite put it into words.
Oh, but you have to use the phrase error signal.
That's true. It's not a complete PID analogy unless you say that.
Something I would like to point out, though, I don't know if a lot of people know these are out there. I guess we should. All the financial accounting statements for publicly traded companies are easily found on the SEC's website, the Securities and Exchange Commission's website. And it's fascinating to go look at, you know, the snapshots of how, you know, various different types of companies, especially technology companies, work, how they describe their various business units, what their what their cash flow and what their balance sheets say. It's fantastic. You can literally go to the SEC's Edgar search form and type in the ticker symbol for Microsoft or Apple and pull up basically as long as they have electronic records. You know, so for Microsoft, probably back into the early 90s, Google back to, when did they first file, 2003, 2004?
Don't know. Sounds about right.
And they often, I mean, and they do talk, I believe they're required to by law. They talk quite honestly about their it's a prospectus about their expectations for their future business and what their huge obstacles may be. And there are consequences if they're not honest about it. I think as Facebook, or more importantly, the people who put together Facebook's IPO have found out.
Yeah, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, comes down pretty hard. Well, they at least slap the back of the hand of companies that don't do honest reporting.
And that's not just honest in terms of numbers. It's in terms of if you're not honest about your expectations for the business or the business's prospects.
Right. And so there are a lot of things like they have rules where if you have an IPO, there's a period where you can't talk about the IPO and a mm-hmm. period where you can talk about. And so there's lots of rules about what you can and can't do from a financial standpoint. Oh, IPO, initial public offering, when a company first sells its stock to the public. So you mentioned, Brian, the balance sheet, which is one of the standard financial statements. So there are four financial statements that you'll almost always find. There's the balance sheet, which says, at a given point in time, how are we doing? So the balance sheet will have a date, and it'll say, how are we doing as of this date? The second one is an income statement, says, and that will have a period, like for the year ending December 31st, 2012, it'll say, how much money did we make during that period? Thirdly, there'll be a statement of cash flow, because cash is the gasoline in the engine of any business. If you run out of cash, you can borrow more money, but you know, if you run out of places to borrow from and you run out of cash, you're done. So that's important. And there's also a statement of retained earnings, which is usually a pretty, you know, boring three-line statement that basically says this is how much more the company is worth this period, you know, over this period, over this year. Did the value of the company go up or down? So if you go to the SEC website, the Edgar website, or you just Google, you know, GM balance sheet, GM income statement, you'll get the General Motors financial statements. Google has them and Yahoo Finance has them. You can find them pretty easily. But let me get to the balance sheet, because that gives us one of the equations that accountants have to balance. So on a balance sheet, why do we call it a balance sheet? Well, it's because the accountants have to balance three things. They have to balance assets, and those are things that the company owns. And you can have tangible assets, things, physical items. That includes cash, equipment, buildings, parts. You can also have intangible assets. And so there'd be things like patents and copyrights and trademarks and goodwill.
You can quantify goodwill?
You can quantify goodwill. And here's how you quantify goodwill. Let's say that our business, you know, ABC business, trades on, you know, on a stock exchange, and it is valued on the stock exchange, you know, the number of shares. Let's say we have 1 million shares and it trades at $10. So the value of the company is $10 million.
Okay.
And then you go to ABC Company and you add up all the assets it has, you know, its plants, its buildings, its trucks, its parts, and it's worth $5 million. So the company is worth $10 million, but it only has assets of $5 million. What's the difference?
$5 million.
The difference is $5 million, and we have to attribute it to something. And so what can we attribute it to? Well, it must be goodwill, because all those purchasers of the stock are willing to pay twice what it appears to be worth on the asset page. So in the accounting world, that's what goodwill is.
I'm going to try and work goodwill into my next design. No. I know it doesn't meet that spec, but if you saw goodwill, it's off the charts.
Right. So the first thing that accountants have are assets. The second one are liabilities. And liabilities are debts the organization owes to non-owners. And so that would include, you know, the salaries that you have to pay the employees, bank loans that you owe banks, prepaid orders where a customer has paid you money, but you haven't given them anything yet. You owe them. That's a liability. And so typically we think, okay, we've got assets, we've got liabilities, what's left? Well, if you're doing well, your assets are worth more than your liabilities, which means that, you know, after you pay off your liabilities, you have something left. Businesses like that. And that difference is called equity or owner's equity. But basically it says, what is the business worth once you take your assets and subtract off your liabilities? And so to accountants, all that has to add up. Assets has to equal, it must always on a balance sheet. When an accountant puts out a balance sheet, this will match. Assets equals liability plus equity or owner's equity. So if you look at, if you go and you Google, you know, General Motors balance sheet or any, you know, publicly traded balance sheet, you will see these categories. It'll be assets, liabilities, and owner's equity. So I'm not going to go through each of the components that can make up that. I will mention one thing, you know, one distinction that gets made frequently on these things. And you'll see under assets, you'll see current assets and then long-term investments. So what's this current assets? What makes an asset current? Well, both assets and liabilities are current if they have to be paid within 1 year or they can generate income within 1 year. So under assets, obviously cash is a current asset because it is cash right away. Stock holdings, if you own stock in a different company, you can sell that on a publicly traded market pretty quickly. So that would be a current asset. If you have accounts receivable, that is your customers owe you money and they would typically pay you within, say, 30 to 60 days, that's a current asset. But if you have a long-term loan and somebody's not going to pay you, you've loaned money to another business or company and they're not going to pay you for 3 years, then that's a long-term investment. It's not current. Mm-hmm. So on both assets and liabilities, you'll see it separated out as current assets and current liabilities. And the meaning of current is that it'll either be paid or can be generate cash within a 1 year period.
Do accountants ever use the terms liquid and illiquid with respect to those?
Sure. So something that's liquid is more easily converted to cash.
Yes.
So they'll talk about liquidity. And so obviously accounts receivable, you may not think, well, is that, you know, if people have already paid you money for something, you've already shipped the product and they owe you money, so you have accounts receivable. That's an asset. Can you sell that? Yeah, there are collection agencies that they won't give you, you know, a dollar for a dollar's worth of receivables, but they'll give you, depending on your customers, you know, 90 cents or 80 cents, or, you know, if you have bad customers, 10 cents on the dollar, but you can generate cash off those receivables. So, but obviously that's, if you have bad customers and somebody has to go collect the money and knock on doors, that's a lot less liquid than customers who are paying you every month after 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
So sure, the term liquidity refers to how easily something can be converted to cash.
So, Jeff, what does it mean when assets depreciate?
Okay, so let's say you go out and buy a truck, and it's a nice truck. You spend $30,000 on that truck. And when you drive it off the lot of the truck dealer, Is it still worth $30,000?
Depends how nice.
Yeah, I guess sometimes it goes up. Usually it goes down a little bit. And certainly exactly. After you've driven that truck hard for a year, you've put 18,000 miles on it, you've towed your boat to the lake a couple times, is it still worth $30,000?
No, clearly not.
Clearly not. And probably after 10 years, you've driven it hard, and now you have 180,000 miles on it. It's worth something less than $30,000, right?
Mm-hmm. I think it'd be worth more if it served you faithfully for 10 years. It's probably worth its weight in gold.
Well, sure, there's a sentimental value, but to the market and in financial world, all that matters is what's the market value? What can you get somebody else to pay you for it? Now, if you can get...
It went up in goodwill. I'm going to work that into every episode now.
Okay. So the idea is that when you buy the $30,000 truck, or you spend $1 million on the machine, or you buy you pay $1 million in renovating the plant, that becomes an asset. You've increased an asset. There's a section typically called plant, property, and equipment, and that are those are the fixed assets that you have to do your work. That goes up in value. You spent the money. You spent the $30,000, so that's the expense. You get an asset in return. And if you spent $30,000, we assume that it's worth $30,000. And so onto your assets goes a list of whatever the item is, and you get credited for $30,000. But we recognize, and accountants recognize, that over time, the value of that becomes less. So depreciation is the amount that you depreciate, that you remove from that asset value. So there are several ways to do it. The most typical way, the easiest way, is what's called straight line depreciation. And so what you say is if the life of that truck is 10 years and when I sell it, it's worth, we'll make it easy, it's worth nothing, then each year I'm going to depreciate $3,000 from the value of that truck. And so at the end of year one, you show on your asset, on your balance sheet, you show an asset of $30,000. Less depreciation of $3,000, which gives you a net asset of $27,000. And the second year, you depreciate $3,000 more, and so now it's down to $24,000. Thank you. and so on and so forth. Now, is that accurate? It probably is not straight line depreciation, but it's often done because it's easier. There are also other accelerated depreciation methods that try to more accurately match the value of the asset as it loses value over time.
And there's models for various asset classes and how they depreciate.
Yeah, and there are rules about what type of asset you can depreciate over what length of time. So, things like land never depreciates. You can't depreciate land. Big ticket items like
what if Chernobyl happens?
Sorry. But that could be a different kind of expense or cost or something, but typically real estate does not depreciate.
Filed under bigger problems.
That's true. You'd write it off in the hazmat suits for your employees.
Right. If you've got we don't have fax machines. You have a copy machine, then you may, it depends. I don't know what exactly the rules are, but it'd be something like 5 or 10 years you could depreciate that over. If you have a big plant, you may depreciate that over 30 years. So there are accounting rules, and talk to your local accountant. But there are rules for how you depreciate. But the idea is that the term depreciation means the amount that is taken away from the asset value to account for the fact that there is degradation in the value of that asset over time.
And because we're all math geeks, is that typically linear?
The depreciation. Well, straight line accounting or straight line depreciation does make it linear, yeah.
Okay.
So if you don't want that, there are other depreciation methods. I won't get into all the details, but they're typically under the heading of accelerated depreciation.
So another way accountants are just like engineers. You say, well, this isn't quite linear, but let's assume it is and move on.
Yes. My chicken is now a sphere.
Yes. Until proven otherwise, this is a sphere and this is a straight line.
Right. Right.
Next slide, please.
Right. Oh, and before we leave the balance sheet, I'll just real quickly say that the business can raise money two ways, sell stock or borrow money. And so under the owner's equity, you'll see a listing of common equity. And that's the money that was raised by selling the stock. So that's not what the current stock price is. You go out and buy a share of General Motors, since I'm using General Motors as our example, General Motors doesn't get any of that money. Whoever owned the share of General Motors gets that money. But General Motors only got money when they issued an IPO. We talked about that earlier, an initial public offering. And so at the initial public offering, the company sells stock to shareholders. And at that point, they get that money. And that money that goes to the company is reflected in the balance sheet under common equity. But from then on, the stock value may go up and down, but the business doesn't get any of that money. They, you know, what they get is only at the time of the IPO. So they don't sell stock. So typically you'll hear about companies selling stock to raise money. I guess they can do it after the IPO in a subsequent offering. But typically when you're buying shares, you're not buying them from the company. You're buying them from other shareholders.
I don't think I knew that. But my knowledge of accounting and economics is abysmal.
All right. Well, so let me quickly go through the other statements. There's an income statement in addition to the balance sheet that says where you are at a point in time. There's an income statement that says, did we make money over this period of time? And so that will show revenues, and then you'll subtract off expenses. And then, you know, so you make you'll have sales revenue, and then you'll subtract off the cost of goods sold, how much you paid to make those things. You'll subtract off operating expenses. You'll subtract off administrative expenses. And then you'll have to subtract off financial expenses like interest expenses and then tax expenses. And you do all that, you finally get to your net income. And you think, well, we're done now. Not quite yet. If you've made money, or even if you haven't made money, companies sometimes want to reward their shareholders for being shareholders, and they pay them dividends. So once you figured out how much you made, then you have to subtract off the amount you pay to shareholders in dividends. And then whatever's left at the very bottom is your profit, and that gets transferred to retained earnings. Because the company, if you've made money, the company's worth more.
It's a crazy concept, but I'll buy it.
Yeah, so without going into the details of the income statement, it basically gives you your revenues and then subtract out all the costs you have to spend. So the point I'll make is that people usually don't have a good idea of what kind of profit companies make. And it varies from industry, but you want to take a guess as to what the average net profit margin of the S&P 500 was in 2011?
3%.
5.210. Sorry.
Oh, 5.210. Well, it was 10.6%.
Damn. So close.
So close. Software companies made 21.7%. Apple is closer to like 40%, which is why they generate so much cash. If you're running a small business, then you need to be at least in the 15 to 20%. And probably better to be in the 40 to 50%, because you have ups and downs, and you don't. So if it's costing you $100 to make your products, and you're selling it for $101, trying to be nice to your customers, you're not going to last for very long, because something's going to break or something's going to go wrong, and you don't have many reserves. So better that it costs you $100 and you're selling it for $150, you're selling it for $200, so that you have some reserve to stay in business. And although that sometimes runs counter to what we think as engineers, if I want to be fair to everybody, if you're not in business to support your product, that's not fair to your customers.
True, true.
Okay. And the next big piece of financial accounting is the cash flow statement. And it will show basically three sections: operating activities, investing activities, and financing activities. But it says basically, how much cash did we bring in? How much cash did we send out? And if all goes well, you have more cash coming in than cash going out.
If all things go well.
So for instance, a machine shop that I worked at, in the conference room, they had a big sign that said, happiness is positive cash flow. Okay. it wasn't making the customer happy. It wasn't making the company worth a lot. It was happiness is positive cash flow, because truly, the business stalls out and dies if it's starved of cash. So that's a timing issue. You have to make sure that the cash is coming in before the cash gets spent, or you have to borrow the cash or sell parts of the company to raise the cash. But that's a lot of what accountants do, is to, you know, or financial advisors, you know, financial officers, chief financial officers. That's what they do. Make sure the money's there when you need it. And so the final statement you'll sometimes see is a statement of retained earnings, which basically repeats how much money, how much more the company is worth over some period of time. So that's a financial accounting. The other side of accounting is managerial accounting, where you process the financial records for internal decision making. And so you'll see a lot more granularity on the managerial accounting side. And so when we make those expense reports and they want to know where the money came from and where it's going, they're trying to match up expenses, and they want to know specifically, was this a research expense? Because that gets treated differently than a manufacturing expense. Is this getting paid out in a year? Because that's a current expense that's different than a long-term expense. So you're wanting to take a look at the activities of the business and find out which activities are raising money and which activities are costing money, and make decisions accordingly.
And sometimes silly decisions, like don't drink the free coffee we give you because we're trying to cut back costs.
Exactly.
I think he was referring more to we fixed the glitch type problems.
True.
For those who have seen Office Space.
The type of expense comes an issue in managerial accounting. There are four types of costs that I'm going to list, and each and every cost can be defined by these four descriptors. Okay, the first one is fixed cost, and those are costs that do not change with the level of production. So that'd be like rent, insurance, utilities, cost of a manager, as opposed to variable costs, which are costs that rise and fall with the level of production. So that'd be like parts and labor, that if you have hourly employees or you have salaried employees where you can directly assess their work onto particular products, those would be variable costs. So you have fixed and variable costs. And then secondly, you have direct and indirect costs. So direct costs are costs that can be directly traced to the production of a product or service, and indirect costs are costs that cannot be directly traced to the production of a particular good or service. So let me give you an example of those four combinations. So a direct variable cost would be the cost for parts. It's a direct cost because it goes into a product, but it varies with the level of production. You make a lot more of them, you have a higher direct variable cost. A direct fixed cost would be like the supervisor's salary. That cost doesn't go up and down with the production level because he's still hired. That's a fixed cost, but it can be directly assigned to a product because that supervisor is looking over that product. An indirect variable cost would be something like machine repair. So it's a variable cost. It goes up and down with production. If you do a lot more production, you'll have more repair costs, but it's not directly associated to the product itself. So it's an indirect variable cost. And an indirect fixed cost would be something like rent or your lease. You've rented the building. That cost is fixed because it doesn't go up and down with the production level, but it's indirect. You've rented the building regardless of which product you're producing. In managerial accounting, when you hear them talk about costs, direct costs, indirect costs, all that stuff, that's what they're talking about.
The more you know.
One of the terms that comes up a lot, and I'll sort of close with this, is the idea of overhead. So the indirect costs are what we typically know as overhead. So the direct costs, you know, we need the parts, we need the labor, we need the electricity, whatever. Well, the electricity may be direct or indirect, depending on how you account for it. And that's a managerial, you know, that's an accounting decision. And that's the point I wanted to make, is somebody gets to arbitrarily decide how that overhead gets allocated. So first of all, the indirect costs are what we call overhead. So the question is, how do you allocate that overhead? Where do you put it? So the company could decide, well, we're going to eat all the overhead ourselves. And so, Brian, your division doesn't have to cover overhead costs, and Carmen, your division doesn't have to cover overhead costs, and we'll just eat it off the bottom line. But they don't like to do that, because then they have to explain why their overhead is so high or where their overhead is going. So typically they allocate the overhead to the divisions or to the products. And so the question is, if, let's say out of, we've got 1,500 hours of production. and each of you, your divisions use up 500 hours. Then on a labor basis, each of you was using a third of the available labor hours. So when I get around to allocating the overhead, I go, well, based on labor, you each get a third of the overhead. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. But here's the arbitrary part. I don't have to base it on labor. I could base it on electricity usage. And so now if I can track what electricity usage you have, then I can allocate the overhead based on that. Or I might allocate it on square feet of production space. So if that's the case, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to make all your machines have a real small footprint, so they're very tall, so that you get allocated less of the overhead because it's being allocated based on production space or square footage in the manufacturing plant. So my point is that these are all management decisions that can be made fairly arbitrarily. How are we going to distribute? How are we going to allocate the overhead? And there's no, you know, hard and fast rule about how that is done. But what I'll point out is that in the, doing the financial analysis, financial ratios are used a lot. For instance, there's a ratio known as the current ratio, which is current liabilities to or current assets to current liabilities. Kind of tells you how well the company can pay its obligations in the short term. There's another one known as return on investment, which is the expected gain you get minus the expected expenditure divided by the expected expenditure. Once again, that doesn't tell you the time value of money, but it's a ratio on how well a project might do. My point is that those types of numbers get looked at by management. And so sometimes the decisions further down the line are made in order to support good-looking ratios on the balance sheet and the other financial statements.
Following you so far.
Okay. So when the accountants come and they want to keep track of where the money's going and what bucket it goes into, because they've basically got lots of buckets to collect all these costs. Remember, they have equations that they have to balance. That's the reason they're being so persnickety about it, is that in their world, they have to make sure all these costs balance. They have to make sure that the money is ready when it needs to be ready.
Got to optimize all these different ratios.
They have to optimize ratios. They have to make sure that it's done. They have a job of, in the same way that engineers have to please their managers but make the machines work or make the product work, the accountants have to please the managers and make sure the financials work. So they have kind of a similar role that the engineers have.
Yeah, but we have it a little easier, I guess. When something doesn't work, we can just beat on it with a wrench. They have nothing to beat.
That's true.
So you think.
That's true. And the final closing idea I'll give you is, in the same way we have to worry about dynamic systems and the way things change, they have to worry additionally to the timing of expenditures. They have to worry about the time value of money, which is obviously, if I offer to give you $1 million today or $1 million a year from now, you're going to choose
$1 million today.
Right. Because you can make it, if you have $1 million today, you can make interest on it in the intervening year. So not only do they have to worry about all these accounts and timing of these things, but they have to deal with the fact that a dollar today is not the same as a dollar tomorrow, which is not the same as a dollar a year from now. So having gone through that, are there any other major accounting questions that you had that I didn't get to?
Not off the top of my head, no. But my knowledge is pretty abysmal to begin with, so this is pretty informative for me.
I'm going to leave it for the second podcast.
Yes.
Oh, the Cooking the Books podcast.
Yes.
money laundering.
Right. So
it's a three-part series.
Right. So you may get a sense here with all these things that have to balance that cooking the books is not just a matter of just erasing one number and putting in a different number. It is, again, sort of like the engineering method of, you know the answer to the homework solution, but you don't know quite how it got there. And you've got to work it so that certain things still balance, so that when the grader goes through the equation, the right equations balance, but you kind of hide the fact that some miracle occurs before you arrive at the answer.
you get so far down the proof, and then you just say, therefore.
Right. Right. So
we had a professor who'd call those leaps of science.
It's also amazing that accounting becomes so critical as organizations grow in size that even when it might be not advantageous to keep books. You still have to, otherwise the organization's unrunnable.
Right.
A good example being, you know, Capone going to jail because somebody was willing to share the organization's books and show they weren't paying taxes on revenue. You know, you have to ask, why would an organization that's dealing in illicit businesses keep books?
Right.
So I have to.
Well, and the advice that was given to me and I followed it and have suggested to other people that are starting businesses is that before you do anything, before you get very far at all, you need to find an attorney and you need to find an accountant. It starts getting complex even for a small business, making sure that you've got the taxes paid. Now all of a sudden you're having to pay quarterly taxes. You're having to pay, if you have employees, you've got to pay their FICA taxes. You've got to pay the state taxes. Making sure all that gets done right, it's, at least in my opinion, is easily worth the cost of an attorney or an accountant to take care of that, because you can get hammered pretty hard by the IRS or the state Department of Revenue if you don't follow their rules.
Oh, yeah. Seems like way more trouble than it's worth. You don't have any time to make your fancy widget that you were trying to build in the first place.
Yeah, you've got plenty of time spent trying to build the product and find customers. Okay, well, we've run well over our typical hour. Hope that we didn't get too dry in our discussion of accounting, but thought I'd pass along just a few tidbits of how accounting is like engineering.
If we get a bunch of WAV files with people snoring, we know it was a bad episode topic. But I liked it.
Well, good. We've got some exciting episodes coming in the future, and so I hope that even if this one wasn't your cup of tea, you'll come back and listen to some future stories of engineers and their adventures. All right. Well, we'll call this one done.
All right.
Hope you guys have a great week, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Engineering Commons.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.